Hello, I'm Adam, and welcome to Tales from the Potting Bench, a gardening podcast where you'll hear tales and stories from the most interesting and different people from the world of both indoor and outdoor gardening. This season is sponsored by the wonderful people at PlantGrow, producers of award-winning organic fertilisers made with zero chemicals. Great for your garden and even greater for the planet. This episode features Chris Wiley, owner of plant trial company So Successful Limited. We talk all about the tests and checks that plants go through and also about the future of peat-free growing. I distinctively remember seeing you on Instagram for the very first time, and it was with Lizzie from the Rose Press Garden, and she was talking about the pot toppers. So how did So Successful come about, and what is it?
So I started off while I was at school. I had a part-time job at a local nursery near to where I lived. I'd do that every weekend while I wasn't at school. Then I moved on. I was persuaded. I stayed there for a few years and done an apprenticeship. And the owner of that business said to me, look, I can't teach you everything you need to know in this industry. You're going to need to go elsewhere, unless you really want to stay here, to broaden your knowledge. So that's when I approached Thompson and Morgan, the brand leading online retailer, as many people will know. And I got in touch with Michael Perry, Mr. Plant Geek, who was doing a talk at a garden centre, or a garden club even, local to me. And he managed to get me a job in their trials department. And it was from there I spent a few years working on their new breeding trials. And then I decided to go it alone. I was working in Ipswich, which was about half an hour commute from where I lived at the time. And I went it alone, doing a lot of work for the ex-managing director of Thompson & Morgan, who had approached me and said, Chris, I like what you've been doing. Can you run some plant and product trials for me? So I went self-employed and done that for him and various other bits and pieces. And then I realized there was a gap in the market for sort of trialing new plants and products. So Thompson & Morgan had left the trial site I worked on about year or two after I left there, and that greenhouse, about an acre of glass, was not being used anymore. So I approached the landlord and said, can I rent it from you? So she said, oh yes, please. I didn't want to knock it down, but there's no one using it, so if you want to use it, fine. So that's where that started. So I set up So Successful Limited, and I specialized in independent plant and product trials. And I'm also in a lot of seed production as well, which is where you grow a big batch of plants, and mainly wholesale companies buy the seed off you to use for their own seed packets and plant production. And I've also been working growing plants for flower shows like Chelsea and BBC Gardeners World Live. So it's been very eye-opening and something that I've always loved doing and got a passion for plants. And it's just the most amazing thing at the moment.
It really sounds it. I had no idea that the glass house that you've got was from Thompson and Morgan. It's kind of like almost full circle in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny how these things come around. I've always said, never get on the bad side of people, because you never know what's around the corner. And I never once, while working for Thompson Morgan, did I know I would soon be running the nursery on that site. So yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I think the whole world of plant trials is really interesting, and is perhaps a world that I would say a lot of gardeners probably don't even know necessarily exists. And I, to be totally honest with you, I think unless you're fully ingrained within horticulture, I just don't think you would necessarily think that plants have to be trialed, but of course they do. As soon as you start talking about it, of course they do, because they don't just go into production and then they pop out on the shelves at a nursery or a garden centre. So what is the kind of that life cycle from the idea of a plant, or the start of kind of either a new plant or what have you, to it getting to a garden centre or a nursery?
So plant breeding can take well up to and above 10 years to get the plant from propagation, from initially seeing the plant to bulking up in big enough quantities for retail sales. And a few of those years are based on trialing the plants to see if they withstand various weather conditions, if flower performance is better than that of a previous strain or group of plants. There's many things which need trialing and to see if it's suitable for the UK climate. And so that trialing plants usually takes 2 or 3 years out of, let's say, 10 years. And the rest of that time is spent bulking up the plant, whether that's cuttings, seed raised, and just seeing it through. So a plant breeder can take anywhere up to 10 years to actually get a return on their investment.
That's absolutely remarkable. Without giving away your secrets, because obviously you can't tell us exactly what you do, I'm sure. What does a plant trial actually involve? So say, what's something that you've recently been trialing that's gone to market? So what does that involve?
So I trial anything from bedding, perennials, shrubs, whatever people throw my way. I can pot up in the conditions that they say are most suitable for comparison trials. So what I'll do is let's say I've got a bedding plant. I can't give too much away of what I do, but let's say I've got a bedding plant, which I want to compare to another plant to see if it's better and to see if it performs in various compost mediums. So obviously the way we're going now is peat-free. So it's trialing in peat-free composts to see if they live up to the expectations of what the breeder has come up with. So I will be assessing against, if it's indoor grown in the greenhouse, I'll assess against pest and disease resistance, how much watering it takes up compared to that of its comparison plant, many things. There's a whole list of things I trial.
So do you have an outside space as well as the glass house?
Yeah, so a lot of it's done in the greenhouses, but obviously some of the trials need to be outside, so I have got outside space as well.
So you mentioned there about different mediums. Obviously we're very much of a, it's not a new thing, peat free obviously, but it feels as though it becomes a slightly kind of new conversation every now and again. And bearing in mind that this, when this will go out, so when we're recording this and when it will go out, it will be slightly different times. But there is quite a large conversation going on about peat at the moment that has either helpfully or unhelpfully been reinvigorated by quite a well-known gardener. But I think what that has done, that has kind of reinvigorated that conversation, as I've said, which is no bad thing necessarily. Where do you kind of stand in terms of trialing with different mediums, as you've said, but in terms of alternative mediums as well?
So I've been trialing various compost mediums for the past couple of years, two or three years, trying all the brand leaders out there. So comparing that to peat, because I've always grown in peat for years. And it's only in the last couple of years, which I've actually thought twice, now it's come to light, the issue, I need to stop using it. So I've been trying sort of for my benefit as well, because being commercial, it's different than buying as an amateur gardener from a garden centre or a DIY chain. Commercial, obviously, you need a lot of volume of compost. And unfortunately, a lot of the peat frees have been very inconsistent. It might be one batch, one pallet of compost, which is absolutely fine. But another pallet would be awful because it's done in different batches. But in a garden centre, if you go to buy one or two bags, you won't really notice a difference, but commercial you do. So you need that consistency. So that's why I've been doing a lot of trials. And a big one, I went a couple of years ago, just before the first lockdown, I went and traveled to Sri Lanka to study coir in detail, because it was seemed to be a good alternative at the time. So I went to see how it was produced, see what the cost differences were, whether it was more sustainable. I spent a week there talking to various companies, one of which everybody will know, which I won't give away names, but I went to see sort of the brand leaders over there. And it was really interesting. And there's a lot of things which I found out which isn't spoken about over here. At the moment, there's a lot of bad press about coir because of obviously the carbon footprint and being manufactured in Sri Lanka and India. It's quite a way across the world to transport it. So there's a lot of people taking a dislike to coir. However, the consistency of coir is there. Unlike bags of compost, whether it be peat-free or peat, you buy a 70-litre bag, it's a big bag. Whereas cocoa peat can be compressed to half of that. So if you buy a 70 litre block, it won't be very big. It's like a normal box coming through the post. It's quite small. So you can fit a lot more in a container. And how a lot of the people at the moment buy in coir is by sea freight. So you haven't got all those air miles and pollution in the air. You've got a container ship of thousands of containers, and coir being one of those. So it's got a very little carbon footprint. I think coconuts, they produce crops on average about every 45 days. So you've got the consistency of the coconuts being produced, because coir is the husk of the coconut, the outside of it. So when the coconut drops, you obviously can drink the inside of it, and then what's left, the shell, you can produce coir. That's what your doormats and everything are kind of generally made of,
right?
So you've got the everything is there to make it a good alternative to peat. And the water they use, coir has got to be washed through, because it's got a lot of things you don't want in a medium. So it's got to be washed, and that water isn't just used once. A lot of these companies tend to recycle their water and use it for up to 10, 20 times. So washing that coir in the same water, but rinsing it through, they're recycling a lot more than people think. And I think it's a very good alternative.
That's really, really good to hear, because I think you're totally right about the way that coir kind of goes in waves in terms of it's generally very well thought of as an alternative, but then there is always there's always going to be an argument for whatever the alternative is, that we have to factor in carbon emissions, etc. But all of those kind of things that you've just said have clearly highlighted that it is a valid alternative. And I think you're absolutely right about the recycling element and all that kind of stuff. And it is essentially, oh, correct me if I'm wrong, it is essentially kind of a byproduct of the coconut industry, isn't it, really? So it would otherwise, I don't know what would, I suppose it is used for lots of other things, as you've said. So it's making use of something that would otherwise potentially be wasted.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing I thought about the other day, interestingly, it never crossed my mind, but compost, when you buy it from the garden centre, you'll buy it in plastic bags, which generally can't be recycled.
Yeah.
Yes, you can put your grass trimmings in there, take them away for disposal and whatever, but then they have to go in landfill. And I hate sending stuff to landfill. I despise it. I try and recycle everything I can. With cocoa, you can just simply wrap it in a cardboard box and send it through the mail. Couriers take it. They don't take bags of compost because they split in the post.
Yeah.
But simple cardboard boxes of coir. Cardboard you recycle. Coir you've used. No disposal to landfill. So for me, it's the winner out of everything.
So what are the arguments, because for every argument for, there is an argument against. What are the arguments against coir then?
Personally, I don't think there are. I think it's the mileage coming all the way from India and Sri Lanka, but obviously we can't grow coconuts over here in the UK, and nor can you in the rest of Europe. But I think that is the only downside. But by coming by sea freight, you've reduced that so much that if you're sourcing generally with peat-free wood fibres and stuff, some of that might be imported from Europe. So actually, if that's coming by air rather than sea from Europe, you're actually much better off getting it from India or Sri Lanka by sea. So yes. I can't see any downsides to it personally.
Well, that certainly opens up a conversation a bit more. Then I put up a post recently asking people's opinions on whether, if they was to go to the garden centre and the plant that they were going to buy was going to come in a coir pot as opposed to a plastic pot, would they be prepared to pay slightly more for it? Do you think that's a possibility of happening in garden centres more?
Yeah, well, also funny you should say that. I've just this morning before our call, I've been speaking to a company about potentially buying in to replace all my plastic pots, buying in coir pots, because I think it's a great alternative. And yes, it does cost more. So that cost has obviously got to be passed on to the end consumer. You're talking pennies. It's not much compared to inflation as it stands at the moment with other mediums. But But yeah, I think it's an excellent alternative. And yes, I would 100% be happy to pay a little more if something was to come in a koi pot, which can also be plunged straight into the ground. So you don't even need to take it out of the pot. It can go straight in the ground and it biodegrades.
Exactly. I think a lot of the arguments, which I didn't really never really thought of, I suppose, before I posted it, a lot of the arguments in the comments on my post were, well, I'll reuse my plastic pots. And obviously you can do that, but you can't do that with koi. But there has to be a point where we have to accept that there is wastage to an extent. We're not going to be in a world where there's completely zero wastage in the horticulture industry. I just don't think that it's not possible. It has to be transported in something and sold in something, doesn't it?
Yes, I think you're exactly right. You've hit the nail on the head there. You're never going to do away with all plastics. Single-use plastics, yes, you can probably do away with quite quickly. And I think we should be doing away with them right now. But a lot of plastics, like plant pots, as you mentioned, you can reuse them for many seasons. I've got plant pots I've used for a few years. And I will continue using them. I won't be throwing them away. I'll continue to use them as best I can and pass them on to others who can make use of them. And I think that there's garden centres, there's some local to me who have a pot exchange scheme now. So it's completely free to take your unwanted pots in for others to make use of. So I think plastic's got its purpose, but yeah, in small quantities.
So for the purposes of your trials, you obviously, as you said, you obviously have to use peat still as a fair comparison. Is there a point where, well, there will be a point, I presume, in the future, but is there a point in the near future where that is something that you won't have to test with?
There will be a point in the future. I think it'll be pretty soon, sooner than we expect. I think with all these petitions and lobbying of governments and local MPs, I think we're due for a lot of change quite quickly, and I'm fully in favour of that. I was asked recently by a blogger if I would sign a petition to ask government to ban the use of peat right now, and I did ask her the question, is this for the home gardener and retail and growers, or is it for just the home gardener? And she couldn't answer that. I think she's implying it should be for both. And I don't think that's fair. I purposely didn't sign it on that ground, because I think it's going to take a lot longer to phase out the use of peat and things like this commercially than it is going to be for the home gardener. There's pros and cons to these arguments against the use of peat and koi, but yeah, personally, it's going to take a few years to phase out everything commercially.
It's certainly not an overnight. There's no overnight solution, is there? There just isn't. So what are you working on at the moment? Is there anything that you can tell us that's exciting that you can possibly tell us about?
I've got something big coming, which I'm going to give you an exclusive on today in this podcast.
Good Lord.
I've recently taken on a company which specializes in snowdrops. There's around 3,000 different varieties of snowdrops, believe it or not. And it's been a passion of mine since I started in the first nursery I worked at collecting snowdrops. Because they're not just white, you can get green ones, gold ones. The famous pink one is yet to come along. That was an April Fool's a few years ago. But it's always expanding. And they've been a real love of mine. I've had an interest in them for years. And I've been building up my collection, buying another couple every year. And I've started giving talks on them this year to local garden clubs. And I've recently taken on this company with over 1,500 varieties of snowdrops. The owners are retiring from the business, and I said I'd take it on for them. So what I'm doing is I'm starting up a brand new online retail store, which specializes partly in the snowdrops, but will also specialize in sustainable plants and products. Wow. So the name of this retail website is going to be the Sustainable Plant Store. Okay. And it will have sections on there with new plants, new and interesting plants, which you've never come across before, and all grown in peat-free compost, whether that be koi or peat-free, in koi pots. So there's no plastic at all, no peat, fully sustainable. And It's a gap in the market which no one else is really specializing in at the moment. So I'm hoping to get that up and running by the end of the year. So that's an exclusive for you for the podcast.
Oh, amazing. I've just suddenly thought of something that when you said about no plastics and things like that, what about plant labels that come with plants at the moment? Because the majority of those are on plastic, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of them are plastic. And I've seen a lot of people using wooden ones, like the ice cream.
Yeah.
Wooden things, and I'm not a fan of those because they don't last a whole season. If you got them in pots on the ground, and you can't write on with, well, you can write them with pencil, but it's very difficult. I always recommend writing plant labels with pencil because it doesn't fade as quickly. But those wooden sticks, they kind of degrade very quickly. The water absorbs into them, so I don't like that. So at the moment, I'm recycling my plastic labels. I've got quite a big stock of them, and I try and rub off. I use pencils, so I just rub it off every season and reuse them. But yes, I've also been using those free lateral flow kits we've had, using those as plant labels. So I'm trying to recycle where I can. So if there's something suitable for a plant label, I will use.
You will use it.
I do think plastic's got its purpose for plant labels.
What I do with mine, I just use sandpaper and just sand them off. It's dead easy to do.
Yeah. So there's ways around it, and there's ways to help the environment. But you also want to remember what you've got and when you planted it. So you've got to bear that in mind.
So moving from plant trials to your own garden at home, I've got three tough questions for you about your garden and just kind of about gardening in general. So if you've listened to the podcast before, you'll know these already. So you may have mentally prepared some answers. So the first question, if you had to redesign your own garden at home with one type of plant, but you can have multiple varieties, what would it be?
Oh, that is a difficult question. I'm always asked this. What is my favorite plant? I can name my favorite tree, but naming a favorite plant is very difficult. I think there's a new one every year. It's a hard one, but I've always had a love for hellebores. Hellebores are a hardy plant which reliably come back every single year, getting bigger year by year. Flowers throughout winter when not much else is flowering, so you've got that interest in the garden with your winter flowering bulbs. So I would say I would cover the garden in hellebores.
Brilliant. If you could only ever use one tool ever again in your garden, and no other tools, what would it be?
Oh, I would probably say it's my Wolfgarten changeable handle with the many attachments. So you've got this pole with, you've got the rake attachment, the hose and everything. So there's many things you can put on this one handle. So I would say that is my tool of choice.
Oh, it's like the Swiss Army knife of the garden world, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. And the final question, and the age old question, if you had to impart one piece of gardening wisdom on a new gardener or a new garden owner, what would it be?
I would say don't make it difficult. Learn on your own. A lot of the gardening books, there's a lot of old-fashioned ways of doing things and thinking. And as you well know, I've been sharing my advice and myths on Instagram, and I shared one just this morning about rooting powder, how people think you should put cuttings from plants in rooting powder before you put them in the compost. Forget that. There's so many myths out there. So don't make gardening complicated. Work with what you've got. Learn by making mistakes. And that's how you'll learn. Don't spend time reading gardening books which will teach you to do it one way when actually there's a new way to do it. Learn on your own. Take advice from other people. So don't make it difficult. That's my advice.
It was interesting to hear Chris's take on the peat-free debate and his thoughts on coir as a viable alternative. You can follow Chris on Instagram at @so_successful to see more about his new venture with snowdrops. Join me next week where I'll have yet another fantastic guest from the world of gardening. Follow me on Instagram @viewfromthepottingbench to find out who that might be.